Okay, this is part three of our interview with Gil Johnson. Today is August 20th, 2018. And we're resuming and talking about Gil's life starting in the late 80s when out of the blue, you had a vocational opportunity to go to Illinois and run the services for the blind there. Why did you go to Illinois and what did you hope to do there?
Well, it was a combination of a number of things, as these things often are. I realized that my time at the lighthouse was, things were changing here, and what I brought to the lighthouse was not as much useful of use to the director. He and I got along well enough, my committee, but I had been, of course, in charge of all client services, and he saw things being done a little differently than that. So I knew that that was what I would continue to do here might not be what I was really as interested in. And when the invitation came to go for an interview there to run a state agency, I mean, I realized what doors that could open for me and what I might be able to bring to Illinois. And our girls, our youngest daughter had just graduated from high school, and so there was no reason education-wise to stay here with her. She didn't quite see it that way. She thought we left her. We got along well with her, and we still do. But it was a jolt for her. But it seemed like the right move. I liked the director of the Illinois agency that interviewed me and hired me. I had a lot of respect for her, and just felt like that was the right move to make.
Mm-hmm. So Voc Rehab is the agency that we love to hate or hate to love, or as you will. What did you know about Illinois Blind Services, and what direction did you want to take them professionally?
Well, I didn't know. I mean, I knew about rehab agencies, having worked in one and met with other directors. But I didn't know that much about the specifics of that agency. What I did know was that the Lighthouse, the Chicago Lighthouse, was a very well-run, strong, employment-oriented agency. And one that we could definitely count on to be of assistance. The director there, Milt Samuelson, was probably one of the best private agency directors that I've ever met. He and I got along really, really well together. I mean, I didn't know that when I went there, but that's how it evolved. And then, you know, I'd met some of the staff, and I was pretty impressed with who I met and what I saw. And it was different than California's because it was a division serving the blind, blind and visually impaired. And so I had, as much as possible in a state agency, administrative management over a staff of about 120 throughout the state, rehabilitation counselors, teachers, mobility instructors, and then contracts that we had with private agencies and the independent living centers.
Had Illinois had a blind director before you?
Yes, it did. A man that, who I never did meet, although I heard a lot about him. And yeah, he had been there about 4 or 5 years, I think, before I came. So it was a good move. The equivalent of the Orientation Center for the Blind, Illinois Visually Handicapped Institute, was there in Chicago and had, again, a pretty good reputation, and that was part of the division that I administered. And so it was much less fragmented than California's was, I felt. And it turned out to be so because we were working with the consumer organizations there, were able to get the division established in legislation as separately administered. Before that, it was that way, but it could have been at the whim of the director to change that.
So it was almost an analog of what California later did with SB 105?
Yes, in a way it was. And, you know, what I learned there, I think, helped with SB 105 a great deal.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned a little bit of consumer organization support for that, but what about your relations with ACB, NFB there in Illinois? You, the director of often the bullseye of complaints and often the person who could do real good. So what was your relationship with the consumer organizations?
It was both.
Yeah.
the two organizations there did not like each other a lot, which was not uncommon, but I was able to forge a reasonably good working relationship with both of them in very different ways. I remember, it was really with the Illinois Council for the Blind that we got the legislation that created the division in legislation. It was with the National Federation of the Blind. One of their concerns was when they would award scholarships to students going into college, the practice had been to count that as income. And so they were eligible, the person who was received a scholarship was less eligible for support from the Department of Rehab. We met with the state president there, and they raised that question, and I was able to convince the director of the department that was the scholarships that were being given were should not be counted as income because they were meritorious. And, it of course made life easier for the student if they got a few extra dollars through a well-deserved scholarship. Mm-hmm. So that, I think, made, that was my first connection with the National Federation in Illinois. And it was, there were some bumps because we did a lot of revision of a total revision of the rules governing the vending program in Illinois. One of my staff, who was a very unique person, was able to get the confidence of the vendors to the point where, and he wasn't a lawyer, but he probably could have been, was able to craft some administrative rules that made some very significant changes in the vending program. And that change was made. We also were able to enable what were then called rehab teachers in Illinois to be case carriers and to the extent that money was available, to have a case services money at their availability to spend on homemaker clients that they were working with. And that had not been the case before. And that involved some reclassification of positions. I got that done through the State Personnel Board.
You know, there's a thought. You're talking about your work in Illinois 30 years ago. There's a thought that we've lost a lot in VR, that the involvement of counselors, involvement, practical involvement with employment and with counseling and many other aspects of the VR system is a pale version of what it was then. What are your thoughts about that?
Oh, I have a lot of thoughts about that. It was a pale version of what was then, and it was a pale version of what rehab was when I started in the 60s. Then we were vocational rehabilitation counselors with a capital V. And we knew there were what we called then, this was California, but many states had the same kind of thing, home teachers. And they worked with clients in their homes as counselor teachers do now. They could spend some money, but they didn't. That money was not the real issue so much, and nor were the number of closures. The emphasis really was on getting people to work.
Mm-hmm.
That, in my mind, deteriorated over the years and maybe the change that's occurring now in rehab, where homemakers can no longer be considered as a what rehab would call 26 closure, may force the agencies back in that direction of helping people go to work. I have some very strong feelings about that, because I really feel as important as helping somebody live independently in their home is, and it is, that's terribly important, and there's more of them probably, number-wise, that what a vocational counselor brings is very unique, and that should, I'd like to see that continued and strengthened.
The two agencies with the most homemaker closures in the states are California and Illinois.
I know that. And the step that I was describing of converting, enabling rehab teachers in Illinois to spend money was a step down that road, of course.
Yeah.
But that was the climate of the times, and it would not have been possible to oppose that. And the reason that I did it was that the rehab teachers there were being treated by their peers as less professional than the rehab counselor was. And I thought that was wrong, because they were all really skilled people with different strengths.
Why would an agency dilute its vocational output? Such an obvious idea. What were the forces that made Illinois and California lessen and lessen and lessen again that direction?
I think it was the Rehab Act of 73. That was a turning point, because prior to that, the whole emphasis of the Rehab Act up until 1973 was employment. And when the 73 Act was passed and the regulations finally implemented 4 years later, independent living centers came on the scene. Again, the homemaker closures were emphasized more. The state was doing everything it could to attract matching money to pull down the federal money. California did. All states did. And so if they could think of any way, legal way, to match the federal money, they would do that. And that, I think, moved us away from the emphasis on employment.
What were your successes in Illinois?
Well, the revision of the rules and the vetting program was one that I felt very strongly about, and it was I took some hits for it, but it did strengthen the program and got rid of some really paternalistic practices, I thought, that were embedded in the rules. That was one. Strengthening the relationship with the private agency. Well, the Lighthouse was really the major private agency in the state. There were some smaller agencies in the rural areas, but mostly it was Chicago Lighthouse. And we did everything we could to strengthen their programs by, you know, through grants and referring people to them, because they were so placement-oriented, both because they ran a workshop so they could hire people there, but they also had placement people that could help our counselors. So I saw that as a real, step in the right direction.
And how long were you director there?
5 years. 5 years. Administration changed there, and the landscape was changing, and I could see the handwriting on the wall that I was that blindness services, not just me, but the blindness services, the emphasis was moved, was there was less support for specialized services, and I could see that coming. And, you know, then the offer by the American Foundation for the Blind to come back to California to work for AFB, the national organization, was very tempting. So didn't take my wife very long to encourage me to do that.
So you came back. This is the first time you've worked for AFB. And tell me what your charge was and what did you do? What year was that you moved back?
1992. Came back, left Illinois. I think we moved in July. I was on the payroll of AFB for the first month or so before we actually made the move. They were willing to let me work by phone and other ways for that first month until we got relocated. So at that time, the offices that AFB ran, there were five in the country. They were called regional offices, and the regional director, which is what I was kind of seen as the eyes and ears of AFB for the region that we were in, and that would have been, you know, the Southwest region: California, Oregon, Washington, Arizona, Nevada. Pretty much the western states. And so part of my job was was being the eyes and ears. AFB then began to change its focus and broaden it. And after a year or two, the term regional office was deleted from that. And it was seen as more of a national office that AFB was running in San Francisco. And one of the reasons I was hired, I know, was because of my background in employment. And over time, I became the director of the National Employment Center. And what my role there was, and we had an advisory board that was built specifically around the idea of employment, was to help with policy development wherever we could, such as SB 105, and to provide training, and we were able to get funds to provide job placement training. We did I think, about 15 different sessions around the country, 8-day sessions, training rehabilitation staff in different states through the National Employment Center that AFB ran. At that time, they had the National Employment Center on Employment, they had the National Center on Aging in Dallas, and then as West Virginia, that area developed, that became their kind of their technology, National Technology Center. Those were the main three focuses at that time that AFB had.
So you're presiding over this office, and meanwhile, in 1992, the Lighthouse has gone through some choppy times. Do you want to talk about the difficulties Lighthouse had then and how it emerged out of that?
Well, when I left the state in 87, I could see that the road was getting bumpy, the portfolio was being diminished. Fundraising was not as vigorous as it needed to be. The director at that time, Mike Camini, was a very nice person, but a very controlling, in a very nice way, a very controlling person, and did a few things. This is by report, but put him in bad stead, not only with staff here, but with the community. And it was really the community blindness groups, not even the organized blindness agent groups, that came to the board and insisted that there be a replacement.
What sort of things?
Well, that's what I say. Some of them were alleged, and some were true. Some of it was his attitude. He, like I say, he was in a very gentle, quiet way, a very controlling person, and he was very sophisticated and knew how he wanted to have things run. He was not paternalistic. He was not anti-blind or anything like that. But he was not one that encouraged innovation and adaptation. Kind of on a more personal level, the Lighthouse had purchased a car for him. It was the practice in those days for agency directors. And he would come up to the Lighthouse and park his car on a white zone, on a white curb, and run into the agency and be there an hour or two. Like, well, it didn't matter. His car could be there. It was alleged that he spent agency money on personal items, shoes, and things. He may have used the agency card. I mean, again, I wasn't here. This is only hearsay for me, but that he may have used the agency credit card to purchase them. I was told that he always reimbursed that, and I believe he did because he was not a dishonest person. But in the eyes of the community, that he was seen as personally promoting his own interests as opposed to the agency. And then he was not really open to input from the blindness community. And so for all of those reasons, and probably others that I don't know about, he was asked to leave. And recruitment went out, and Anita Aaron was hired.
And before we get to Anita and that chapter, I just want to cite a couple of things in time. You were in Illinois, but I heard that in those last years of the 1980s, Lighthouse was actually picketed by blind people who were upset with some of its practices.
That's what I had heard. Also, I never personally saw the pickets, but I did. I mean, the community was up in arms, and there were articles in the Chronicle about the lighthouse and how poorly it was being administered and the treatment of blind clients was seen as paternalistic and not encouraging independence.
This was blind clients in the workshop or elsewhere?
Pretty much throughout the agency.
Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of bad feelings about the dismissal still of O.J. May, the longtime director at Enchanted Hills Camp. Was that still echoing in the late 80s?
Yes, as far as I could gather, it was. She was hired in 1975 as the director of Enchanted Hills, and she did that on a part-time basis, and she was also a counselor at a local school district, so she could do both. She could run the camp during the summer and then do work for the school part-time during the rest of the year. She came on full-time, I think, sometime in the early 80s and took on more of a role in administering both Enchanted Hills Camp and the Recreation Center on Buchanan Street, which basically was a program for older persons to come and spend their days. There was some skill training involved there, but not... It was really a place for blind people to come and be. And so she administered both of those. Well, when money became tighter and tighter and tighter, the director, Mike Kameny, decided that we had to make some cuts, and one of the cuts we made was to cut her back to part-time administering the camp. And that did not go well. She did not like that at all, and I was kind of in the position of, I didn't agree with Mike's decision, but he was the boss. We had to do it. And so she got upset enough that she resigned. But the camp at that time had been recruiting counselors from Europe through a program called Camp America. And every year there would be probably 20 or so counselors hired from different countries in Europe. And they would come over for 2 months or 2.5 months and work at the camp and then go back. Well, they had a real fondness developed in many of them for OJ. And so when she resigned, there was a strong protest over that. I mean, she did resign, but basically she was kind of forced to resign, as I took it. And so that lingered for a couple of years, that bad taste from kind of engendered. I think there was a lawsuit, but I don't know. That was at the time I left, so I don't know as much about that. But it certainly had a lasting effect on, and eventually she did kind of make peace with the lighthouse, but there was always some tensions there. And of course Mike May, her son, Mike was not on the board at that time, but he was a very influential person from the community to the agency, and so things got pretty sticky.
Mm-hmm. So here we are. It's 1992. Khomeini's fired, and now there's a search for a new director. The Lighthouse, in 90 years, had never had a blind director. Did you apply?
I did not. I had applied twice before and was not hired, and I didn't think I stood much of a chance the third time around, so I did not. And then for me, the offer from AFB came through. But actually, this was in 19, I think Anita came on in 90 or 91.
Okay.
So this was before I came back here.
Okay.
But there was, you know, recruitment, and I know there were several of the board members that had very strong opinions about finding a different type of director than we've had before. And so Anita was the first blind director that the agency has ever had. Many of us thought it was about time. And you know, on top of this, of course, I think the endowment was down to less than a year's operating budget.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a lot of dynamics going on.
So here,
at the same time, yeah. Well, I guess it came a little later. In 1989, the Loma Prieta earthquake shook down a number of pieces from the building that the Lighthouse had on Howard Street, 7th and Howard, and it was determined to be not safe to inhabit. That building, the deed for it, when it was given by Stanford, was that it had to be used for employment of blind persons. They finally were persuaded to lift that restriction, which enabled the Lighthouse then to sell it, which they did. I don't have firsthand knowledge of this, but I'm told that around that same time, they sold the building on Buchanan Street that they'd had for years, and got money from, I guess, FEMA to purchase and remodel the building on Van Ness Avenue, 214 Van Ness Avenue. And so that became the center, the focal point for the Lighthouse. And then the Rose Resnick Center, also around that same time, I think that was probably in 92 or so, Rose Resnick resigned and retired. And that agency then merged with the Lighthouse. So it absorbed a lot during those years with the sale of the buildings and the moving, and then the Resnick Center coming in. So there was a lot going on.
Yeah. Probably one of the biggest phases of activity in Lighthouse history there right in the early 90s.
Yes. And Anita was probably the right person to have in place at that time. She was very much of a hands-on person, a director. The staff was, I don't know, 25 or so staff members. So, well, except during the summer when camp was running, but it was, you know, it was not a huge staff. So she was able to keep her hands on pretty much everything. She had convinced the board to set a goal to have build an endowment of $30 million. I don't know if there was a year set for that goal to be achieved. I'm thinking there was, but I'm not 100% certain of that. But Anita took that seriously, and she ran the agency in such a way as that when more money came in than was needed to run the agency, that went into the portfolio. And it did begin to build. And I think it was 1907 or 1908 that the endowment hit $34 million. And that was really a lot due to Anita's diligence and oversight and hard-headedness.
Yeah. What was it like for the first time to have blind director at the Lighthouse, a Braille-using, technology-using blind director? How did that change everything that you saw from the board or from staff perspective?
Well, it was a mix because Anita being very dedicated, high energy, hands-on person, she was everywhere she could be. What I remember, I wasn't at it, but the when she was introduced as the new director, it was a buffet or some kind of food gathering, and here's Anita behind the line serving food, which what that said to the community was, here's somebody that a blind person that is representing what blind people can do, and that said a lot to the community. I know it did. And then, you know, the Lighthouse did some public events and did some award ceremonies that drew a lot of attention, and then began to attract board members that had pretty high visibility in the community, and some money, which didn't hurt. And so all of those things came together, and I think the community in particular and staff, I don't know as much about how staff's feeling, because that was kind of mixed up with the merger with the Resnick Center.
Mm-hmm.
But it had a very definite effect on how the agency, the change in how the agency was run.
Mm-hmm. So let's take those pieces now that became the Lighthouse, the Resnick Center. Rose Resnick was quite elderly when she stepped down. What was left of the Resnick Center when she stepped away, and what continued after the Lighthouse merged with them?
And of course, the Resnick Center closed and the building was sold. I'm guessing that but I don't know this because this was not when I was not here, that the money from the sale of that building also helped with 214 Van Ness and with the endowment.
That address was where?
It was on, I have to think about that, on McAllister, I think. I don't remember exactly where it was. It was over. It wasn't in the Tenderloin, but it was a little closer to North Beach, I'm thinking, where the Resnick Center was. So that closed, and you know, then pretty much the people that were there and the people, the clients that were being served at the Buchanan Street Center then started coming to the 214 Van Ness Avenue location. And frankly, one of the major benefits, if you will, of the Resnick Center's closure was Tony Fletcher. Tony worked for the Resnick Center. He worked there, several years before that program closed, and he was one of those that moved over to the Lighthouse. And, you know, I don't know exactly what his role was initially. I think it was really kind of running the, well, I guess what you could call the senior center portion of the lighthouse. He did that, and then of course eventually he evolved into the running of the camp. But he was a real asset from the resident center for sure. And then there were some board members too, because of the way the merger was structured. I think several, I don't know how many, board members from the Resic Center joined the Lighthouse Board.
Mm-hmm.